happy birthday today to Barbara Lint of Newton, to Betty Ocala of Fort Dodge, to Kathy Lopez of Mason City, and to Eric S. Shank of Des Moines. Happy birthday to all of you. We hope you're here listening today, and we hope you're having a great day. You are joined on your birthday today by a couple of well-known actresses, Claudia Cardinale, who turns 86 today, and Emma Thompson, who turns 65. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And as I mentioned at the top of this shift, we have no obituaries today. So here's Nicole with our next news story.
Stranded sea otter pups paired with surrogate moms in California. This is from the Nation and World Extra, a section of the USA Today. Protected species is relentlessly hunted for fur. This is out of Long Beach, California. Every year, around 10 to 15 sea otter pups are found stranded off the California coast, often because of storms that separate mother and offspring. The Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach is now partnering up with the Monterey Bay Aquarium to pair those pups with surrogate sea otter mothers with the hope of teaching them life skills and returning them to the wild. As part of the program, the aquarium has successfully bonded their first surrogate mom called Ellie and currently an unnamed pup. Megan Smile, the sea otter program manager at the Aquarium of the Pacific, says that mom is going to teach them all the behaviors that we can't teach being people. The adult female will start to mimic behaviors that the pup should learn, and it will help it groom and help it forage, and it will also help it teach prey manipulation, how to open up shells, and anything that they would need to know that humans are not able to teach them. California sea otters are a protected species. After being relentlessly hunted for their unique fur, they have the densest hair of any animal, with up to 1 million hairs per square inch. They were thought to be extinct until a colony of 50 was found off the coast of Big Sur in the 1930s. Now those numbers are up to around 3,000, but more are needed not only for the species' survival, but also to protect California's near-shore ecosystems. Brett Long, a senior director at the Aquarium of the Pacific, says they are a critical sort of predator in that system that keeps herbivores like sea urchins in check so that sea urchins don't overpopulate and take out kelp forests and eel grass beds. The seagrass and kelp ecosystems are credited with creating biodiversity, protecting against climate events, and also are a powerful tool in carbon sequestration, Smile says. Sea otters may be super cute and cuddly, but Long also says they're very territorial and are just, they're a wolverine in the water. And their eating habits are also pricey. They consume 25% of their body weight every day in restaurant-quality seafood. Wow, really? So a 45-pound otter eats 10 to 12 pounds of seafood a day. That means that feeding an otter costs the aquarium $40,000 a year, and it demands constant fundraising. The two aquariums have rescued 8 stranded pups and hope other organizations can join the effort to increase the population in the wild and protect the California shore ecosystem. Let's see who said this. Long says this is a bigger purpose. This is a higher challenge. So we invest and we invest a lot, but we've all now learned to appreciate, boy, you see that juvenile otter survive out in the wild. It just feels incredible. Sounds like we need to go hang out with some otters if you're a seafood fan.
That's amazing, isn't it? Well, that's our feel-good story today. Hope you enjoyed that. This is not quite such a feel-good story. The U.S. will not join response to attack. One day after Iran launched a historic missile and drone strike on Israel, the U.S. stressed Sunday that it is committed to defending its longtime ally, but it would not be, this is the back part of the front page section. It would not be, I'm telling Nicole where I am because I kind of jumped around there so that she didn't know what I was looking at. So let me start this again. One day after Iran launched a historic missile and drone strike on Israel, the U.S. stressed Sunday that it is committed to defending its longtime ally, but it would not be a part of any responsive action that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government could take. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby said the U.S. is not seeking escalation and does not want a war with Iran. The U.S. official who briefed reporters said the U.S. was not involved in the initial Israeli strike that killed two Iranian commanders in Syria earlier this month and led to Iran's assault on Saturday. The official said President Joe Biden sought to take the temperature down in a call with Netanyahu on Sunday night. Biden met virtually with G7 leaders and spoke by phone with Jordanian King Abdullah II earlier Sunday to discuss Iran's attack, which also threatened Jordan and the Jordanian people, the White House said. Both leaders said they continue to monitor the situation and will remain in close touch over the coming days. The U.S. and Iran were in contact through Swiss intermediaries both before and after Iran's attack, a senior Biden administration official told Reuters on Sunday. The official, who was not named, also said reports that Tehran gave regional countries 72 hours notice of the attack were not true. Iranian Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian said Tehran had informed the U.S. that Israel's attack would be limited and for self-defense. He also told Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan that the retaliatory operation against Israel had ended and Iran would not launch a new one unless it was attacked, and that is according to Reuters News Service. Meanwhile, top Israeli officials huddled Sunday to discuss retaliation, but are divided on the method and timing, Reuters reported. Netanyahu's five-member wartime cabinet was expected to meet again to weigh a response to the attack, which has ratcheted up global concerns about a wider Mideast war. Wartime cabinet minister Benny Gantz vowed Iran would pay. He said, "We will build a regional coalition and exact the price from Iran in the fashion and timing that is right for us." Israel and Iran have long been engaged in a so-called shadow war, with Iran using proxies, military groups such as Hezbollah in Lebanon and Yemeni's Houthi rebels, to target Israel, which has undertaken targeted assassinations inside Iran. But the attack marked the first time that Iran directly targeted Israel from its own territory. The assault underscores how the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza, which began with the militants' attacks on Israeli border communities on October 7 of 2023, risks spilling over into a broader regional conflict. Israel's military said that with help from the United States and other allies, it shot down more than 300 drones, ballistic and cruise missiles launched by Iran in response to an Israeli missile strike that killed Iranian military commanders earlier this month in Syria. U.S. fighter aircraft and guided missile destroyers knocked down some of the incoming missiles and drones, according to an official who was briefed on the operation but not authorized to speak publicly. Israeli Defense Systems Arrow, David Sling, and Iron Dome took down most of the attack. British military jets also helped thwart Iran's aerial assault, British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said Sunday. "I can confirm that our planes did shoot down a number of Iranian attack drones," he said. Daniel Hagari, a spokesman for the Israeli military, said in a Sunday briefing that 99% of the threats launched toward Israel territory were intercepted. Hagari said that out of more than 120 ballistic missiles launched by Iran, a small number penetrated Israel's border. The rest were shot down. He said an Israeli Air Force base in southern Israel sustained some minor damage to infrastructure. At least one child was injured. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said U.S. forces intercepted dozens of Iranian missiles and drones launched from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, during a news conference Sunday following a call with Biden and congressional leaders, said that Saturday's military cooperation between the U.S. and Israel and the fact that it had been planned for weeks shows that our commitment to Israel's security is ironclad. Iran's Armed Forces Chief, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, told state TV on Sunday that if Israel retaliates, Iran's response would be much larger than the overnight drone and missile assault. Bagheri also warned that if the U.S. backs an Israeli retaliation, it would lead to the targeting of U.S. military bases. In a separate statement, Iran's president, Ali Behram Raisi, said any new Israeli adventure will be met with a heavier and regretful response. World leaders and officials from China to the UK called for both Israel and Iran to exercise restraint to avoid further escalation. The EU strongly condemns the unacceptable Iranian attack against Israel, Joseph Borrell, the EU's top diplomat, said in a post on X. This is an unprecedented escalation and a grave threat to regional security, he said. The Group of Seven nations said in a unanimous statement that Iran's attack risked what it called provoking an uncontrollable regional escalation. This must be avoided, G7 leaders said. We will continue to work to stabilize the situation and avoid further escalation. In this spirit, we demand that Iran and its proxies cease their attacks, and we stand ready to take further measures now and in response to further destabilizing initiatives, that according to the G7 leaders' statements. The group also said it planned to work closely together to end the crisis in Gaza and recommitted to working toward a permanent ceasefire, the release of all military held hostages, and the delivery of more humanitarian aid to the Palestinian people.
And in brief section, there's four stories today from here in the United States and around the world. We start here in the U.S., where news organizations are urging Biden and Trump to debate. A dozen leading U.S. news organizations are already collectively urge President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump on Sunday to publicly commit to debating each other during the run-up to the November election. The 12 news outlets said jointly, debates have a rich tradition in our American democracy. Having played a vital role in every presidential elections of the past 50 years, dating to 1976. The statement suggested that debates for the current race be sponsored, as they have every election cycled since 1988, by the Nonpartisan Commission on Presidential Debates. Network television outlets accounted for 9 of the letter's signatories, ABC News, CBS News, and NBC Universal News Group that encompasses NBC News and MSNBC, as well as Fox, CNN, C-SPAN, and the PBS NewsHour, Nexstar's News Nation, and Spanish language Univision. Rolling out the group were the Associated Press Wire Service, National Public Radio, and Gannett's national paper, USA Today. Trump, who refused to debate his rivals before winning the Republican primary race last month, has recently been challenging Biden to engage in a one-on-one matchup with him, offering to debate the incumbent Democrat anytime, anywhere, anyplace. Across the pond now to London, debt for nature swaps could give a $100 billion boost to climate fight. Debt for nature swaps, where poorer countries have debt written off in return for protecting ecosystems such as barrier reefs or rainforests, could provide $100 billion for the fight against climate change, according to a new report. The UK-based nonprofit International Institute for Environment and Development based the estimate on the possibility of debt swaps in many of the 49 less developed countries seen as most at risk of debt crisis. Belize, Ecuador, Barbados, Gabon, and Cabo Verde have all done such swaps in recent years. And Laura Kelly, the director of the IIED Sustainable Markets Research Group, said a lot of these debt distress also often are threatened by global warming. They were looking at them. The IMF and the World Bank, whose figures the analysis is based on, estimates the countries focused on collectively owing $431 billion, mostly to wealthier governments, the IMF itself and pension and hedge funds. At the same time, these countries receive less than $14 billion in climate financing, according to OECD figures from 2021. It's significantly less than they need to limit climate change or at least adapt to it. Also in London, Russian-origin aluminum banned after US-UK imposed sanctions. CME Group has suspended from its platform aluminum that's produced in Russia from April 13th, the exchange said on Sunday, after the U.S. and Britain imposed new sanctions on Moscow for its invasion of Ukraine. The Treasury Department in the U.S. and the British government said on Friday it banned the 147-year-old LME and the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the CME. Oh my god, I'm sorry. Okay. They banned the LME and the CME from accepting new Russian production of aluminum, copper, and nickel that's produced from April 13th. The CME told Reuters on Saturday that it does not disclose the origin or brands of the eligible or registered metal that it has in store. They said this was consistent across all of its physically delivered markets. And finally, in Sydney, Australia, police there say a knife attack may have targeted women. Australian police on Monday said the attacker who fatally stabbed six people at a busy shopping center in Sydney's beach suburb of Bondi may have targeted women, as that country mourned the victims and hundreds of people laid flowers near that scene. In the attack on Saturday, five of the six people killed and the majority of the 12 injured were women. Police said on Monday they have now finished taking physical evidence at the Westfield Bondi Junction Mall. Witnesses describe how attacker Joel Conchi, 40 years old, wearing shorts and an Australian National Rugby League jersey, ran through the mall with a knife. He was killed by Inspector Amy Scott, who confronted him solo while he was on the rampage. Police said that Conchi had mental health issues in the past and there was no indication ideology. Ideology was a motive. I think there's something weird with that sentence. But there we have it with the in briefs across the country and the world.
And so we'll return to another short political story. There are going to be more and more of these as we make our way through the year toward the election. This one says a new poll finds Biden catching up to Trump. President Joe Biden is catching up to former President Donald Trump's President Joe Biden is catching up to former President Donald Trump's polling lead, highlighting just how close the 2024 presidential election will be, according to a new poll from the New York Times and Siena College. Trump leads Biden by just one percentage point, with the two candidates at 46% and 45% respectively. The survey is a significant boost for the incumbent president, who has been lagging behind Trump in recent polling. An earlier New York Times Siena College poll released in March saw Trump leading Biden by 5 percentage points at 48% and 43% respectively. But Biden appears to be shoring up support among Americans who voted for him in the 2020 elections. 89% of his 2020 supporters say they would vote for him now, compared with 83% who said the same from the earlier poll. Trump still commands strong support at 94% among his 2020 supporters, but that's a drop from 97% in the March poll. Biden, who has been seen falling support among Black and Latino voters, has started to make gains with those voters as well, a key coalition behind his 2020 victory. His support with those voters, however, still is not as high as it was in 2020, according to the poll. And while age continues to be a major concern for Biden, 69% of voters in the poll say he's too old to be effective as a president, that concern has fallen among voters older than 65%. But other campaign issues continue to pose troubles for Biden. Trump is leading Biden on the economy and immigration, according to the poll. On the economy, 64% approved of Trump's handling of the economy, compared with 63% who disapproved of Biden's handling of it. And on immigration, 50% of the voters approved of Trump's handling of the issue, compared with 64% of voters who disapproved of Biden's job. The poll was conducted with 1,059 registered voters and had a margin of sampling error of plus or minus 3.3 percentage points. And that wraps up the stories from the front page section of the Register. And here's Nicole with more from USA Today.
The front page of the Nation and World Extra section today, jury for Trump, not easy to pick because everyone seems to either love or loathe him. When prospective New York City jurors gather for Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial on Monday, it may be tough to find ones who don't already have an opinion about the brash businessman turned politician who started building his real estate empire in Manhattan decades ago. They'll be questioned by lawyers for the Republican presidential candidate and the state of New York seeking to uncover biases and possible political agendas before impaneling 12 jurors to hear what could be the only criminal case that Trump faces before the November election. Trial lawyer Paul Applebaum says there is almost nobody in New York who doesn't have an opinion about Donald Trump. A lot of people think he's either Satan incarnate or the second coming of Jesus. But even if Trump is a polarizing figure and Manhattan is a Democratic stronghold, having an opinion will not be enough to disqualify potential jurors. Justice Juan Merchan, overseeing this case, already indicated he will not disqualify people based solely on whether they lean Republican or Democratic. Political orientation is not necessarily a cause for bias, according to Jerry consultant Melissa Gomez of IMS Legal Strategies. She says, but if it's so strong that the person will be motivated to convict, that is an issue. At a press conference on Friday, Trump was asked about the start of his trial. He says jury selection is largely luck. It depends on who you get. The criminal case is one of four Trump faces and the first ever for a past or present president. While a conviction would not bar him from taking office should he defeat Democratic President Joe Biden, a Reuters Ipsos poll this week showed that it could be a critical factor for voters. Some 64% of registered voters in the five-day poll that closed on Monday described the charges as at least somewhat serious, compared to 34% who said the charges lacked seriousness. Trump has pleaded not guilty to falsifying business records to cover up a sexual encounter with adult film star Stormy Daniels says that they had. Trump denies having had that encounter with Daniels, whose real name is Stephanie Clifford. Jury selection is likely to take roughly a week in the case. It is expected to last 6 to 8 weeks. Potential jurors are randomly selected from voter rolls and also other state records. Trump has routinely used his legal troubles to rally political support and raise money. He frequently takes to his social media platform to lash out at Merkin and Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who is a Democrat who brought this case. Trump accuses them of carrying out a plot to thwart his election campaign. There are more than a dozen questions about Trump in the list of 42 Merkin approved last week for an initial jury questionnaire. The questions include whether prospective jurors have attended a rally or a campaign event for Trump, whether they follow him on social media, and whether they have feelings about how he's been treated in this hush money case. Other questions cover broader topics like people's professions, educational backgrounds, and hobbies. Potential jurors will also be asked where they get their news and whether they have ever supported extremist groups that include the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, and Antifa. Lawyers would winnow the jury pool down to a process known as voir dire. Questioning will then take place in open court, but jurors will be able to speak to the lawyers and judge separately if they want to keep certain answers private. Merkin has ruled the jury pool will remain anonymous, citing potential harassment. But prosecutors, defense lawyers, and jury consultants will be given the names of potential jurors, allowing for them to scour the internet and social media for signs of potential bias. The prosecution and defense will each be able to disqualify 10 people without giving a reason using peremptory strikes. To dismiss any potential juror, lawyers must convince Merkin there is reason to believe they cannot be impartial. Trump's lawyers sought to move this case to a different jurisdiction, arguing he could not get a fair trial in Manhattan, where Biden defeated Trump with nearly 85% of the vote in 2020. An appeals court on April 8th denied Trump's bid to delay this trial. Both sides will need to be on guard for stealth jurors who had an agenda but pretend to be neutral. That risk is especially high in Trump's case given its implications for the election, according to legal experts. Trial consultant Jeff Frederick says, the political climate in Manhattan seems to favor the government, but it only takes one juror to prevent a conviction, so that is the challenge for prosecutors. Trump's legal team could use his campaign polling data, mailing list, and voter databases to find individuals or precise demographic attributes likely to be sympathetic to Trump, Frederick says. He also says they know who's receptive to Trump's message and who isn't. Trump's camp will likely target less educated, working-class men who have negative views of law enforcement and get their news from more conservative media outlets, according to legal experts. Conversely, prosecutors will likely search for people with college degrees and white-collar jobs who get their news from more liberal news outlets like MSNBC. They're likely to prioritize getting women on the jury, according to legal experts. Asking people the right questions, reading their demeanor, and researching their backgrounds ahead of time can go a long way, but jury selection ultimately involves a bit of luck, Applebaum says. He ended by saying picking one in this case is going to feel like going over Niagara Falls in a barrel.
Oil prices likely to rise after attacks by Iran. This is Dateline London, and it's a story from Reuters. Oil prices, which hit a six-month high on Friday, are expected to rise on Monday after Iran's attack on Israel over the weekend, analysts said. But further gains may depend on how Israel chooses to respond. Concern that Iran would respond to the strike on its embassy compound in Damascus supported oil last week and helped send global benchmark Brent crude on Friday to $92.18 a barrel, the highest since October. Brent settled that day at up 71 cents at $90.45, while U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude futures rose 64 cents to $85.60 per barrel. Trading is closed on Sunday. It is only reasonable to expect stronger prices when trading resumes, said Tomas Vargas of oil broker PVM. Having said that, there has been no impact on production so far, and Iran has said that the matter can be deemed concluded. That's the end of the quote from Mr. Vargas. However fierce and painful the initial market reaction will be, the rally could prove to be short-lived unless supply from the region is materially disrupted. Leaders of the Group of Seven major economies condemned Iran's attack and reaffirmed the G7's commitment to Israel's security during a meeting on Sunday regarding the development of the White House. This was said in a post on X. The G7 leaders discussed sanctions against Iran, a senior U.S. administration official said. There will probably be a knee-jerk jump in oil and potentially natural gas prices when markets open in Asian trading hours, although crude was already pricing in a fair amount of geopolitical risk in anticipation of an Iranian strike, said Amrita Sen, a co-founder of the consultancy Energy Aspects. If the crisis does not escalate to a point that creates supply disruptions, then there will be a downside risk over time, but only once it becomes clear Israel has chosen a measured response, she said. UBS analyst Giovanni Stovano said oil might spike at the opening, and how long any gains last would depend on Israel's response. Whether or not the G7 decides to target Iranian crude oil exports is also a factor, he said. Iran has steeply raised oil exports, its main source of revenue, under the Joe Biden administration. Exports were severely reduced under Donald Trump, who faces Biden in a November presidential election rematch. The Biden administration has argued it is not encouraging Iran to raise exports and is enforcing sanctions. Lower Iranian exports would lead to a further rise in oil prices and the cost of gasoline in the United States, a politically sensitive subject ahead of the elections. Another factor to watch will be any impact on shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, through which about one-fifth of the volume of the world's total oil consumption passes on a daily basis. The commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guards Navy said on Tuesday Tehran could close the strait if deemed necessary, and earlier on Saturday, Iran's state-run IRNA news agency reported a guard's helicopter had boarded and taken into Iranian waters a vessel, the Portuguese-flagged MSC Ares. Crude prices already included a risk premium, and the extent to which it will widen further almost exclusively depends on developments near Iran around the Strait of Hormuz, said Ole Hansen of Saxo Bank. In comments that he said might be going against the stream, Victor Katona, lead crude analyst at Kepler, said he thought the Iranian attack was slightly bearish for crude. And that brings us to the end of this shift. For the last 90 minutes, your readers have been Nicole Tam and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Carol Lockard and Jeff Cassett. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Carol with the opinion piece.
Nicole Russell of USA Today wrote this first opinion. As Trump trial begins, what we conservatives have to ask. And Nicole Russell is an opinion columnist for USA Today, who lives in Texas with her four children. No other president in history has been indicted, but lucky for us, the Republican running for president again has done it four times. Donald Trump, taking it one step further, has managed to do it in different states and has 91 felony charges against him. Trump faces his first trial in one of those cases on Monday, the now infamous hush money case. While this is not the most compelling of the four cases, and indeed, none of them will likely be edge-of-your-seat dramas, it's probably the only one that will happen before the election. As this gets going, the question from Republicans shouldn't be, is this all you got? The question for us should be, what will it take to convince conservatives Trump is not fit for office? As it stands, Trump is accused of falsifying business records regarding a payoff he made to Stormy Daniels. Daniels is a former porn star who has claimed the two had a sexual fling. The prosecution claims Trump bought Daniels' silence in order to avoid a scandal during the 2016 campaign. As a former Trump fan, I know what's tempting about this case. Prosecutors say Michael Cohen, Trump's former attorney, paid $130,000 to Daniels October 16th and over time was reimbursed by Trump via installments labeled corporate legal expenses. In New York, falsifying business records is just a misdemeanor, but apparently it can become a felony if the records were tainted to cover up a separate underlying crime. On the one hand, Cohen has flipped on Trump and will undoubtedly testify against him. The prosecution will also likely try to show a pattern of hush money payments, which won't look good for the former president. On the other hand, forcing the business records falsification to felonies by linking them to another crime is some tricky legal maneuvering. A conviction could theoretically carry more than a decade in prison, but imprisonment is unlikely for Trump. I'll admit, as a former Trump fan who has turned, it's tempting to think that this case is not airtight or, on the scale of crimes, that it doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Giving hush money to a porn star? Falsifying the payoffs? I spent a decade around Washington, D.C. A lot goes on that is worse. Some conservatives have started thinking this way about Trump. That has to change. Republicans have lowered the bar too much for the presidency. In fact, many might insist that this trial, like the 91 felony charges and the other three criminal cases against Trump, are all rigged, that they're all some kind of nationwide conspiracy theory among judges to keep Trump from looking squeaky clean as he runs for office. This theory isn't even plausible. How could every single judge be in on it? And to what end? That's how bad things have gotten in the GOP. We have bargained so hard and lowered the standards so much that accusations of hush money to a porn star and falsified payoffs seem tame in comparison with what exactly? Tax fraud? State and federal election interference? Stealing classified documents and showing them to people without such clearance? This raises two vital questions Republicans must answer. Where exactly is the bar? What exactly would convince us that he is unfit to represent us and unfit for office? Forgive the candor, but this is what I'm paid for. Trump is a narcissistic but whiny, arrogant but thin-skinned elderly buffoon who has conned more than 70 million folks into thinking he's a better alternative than a Democrat. A massive feat in political charisma and Republican strategy, to be sure. He's a fraud, but he's not a psychopath. He's accused of committing just the kinds of crimes one would expect of a high-level, manipulative con man. These are the crimes men like this do because they don't respect authority, laws, or women. These aren't the worst things someone can do, but they're not great things for a Republican president to be legally accused of. And this is just the beginning. This is why looking at Trump's hush money trial and saying, "This is it?" is the wrong thing to say. There shouldn't be any trials or criminal cases or indictments at all. In fact, that doesn't seem like much to ask. The real truth is that any of this is unbecoming to a person running for office, and it does not best represent conservatives. Republicans had years to scout the land for a better man or woman to represent them. They came up with a few ideas, and entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy aside, they were not bad. We could have had Ron DeSantis, and sure, we'd just be talking about the governor's goofy shoes and how he makes people feel a little weird because he's awkward. Meanwhile, Florida's education is fantastic and its economy is booming, and he handles disasters in Disney as well as any conservative. But we can't have that now because so many of you ask for Trump and his 91 felony charges. We could have had Nikki Haley, and yes, we'd be talking about why she goes by Nikki instead of Namrata, or how it's annoying that she was on Boeing's board. Meanwhile, she has experience as a conservative governor and as a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, and she comes across as even-keeled, sharp, and dedicated to conservative principles. Plus, she would destroy President Joe Biden in a debate. Trump, too. But no, Republicans can't have that now. They can't have nice things because they wanted Trump even if he came with four criminal cases. They wanted to debate whether or not hush money to a porn star and falsified business payments was the hill to die on, never stopping to ask themselves why they had lowered the bar that much in the first place. Jeff?
After Iran strikes, Israelis must answer four questions. This piece by Uriel Heilman, who is a native of New York and a journalist living in Israel. He writes, hours before Iran attacked Israel early Sunday with a barrage of more than 300 ballistic missiles, attack drones, and cruise missiles, I tucked my children into bed and read the in-home bomb shelter and readied the in-home bomb shelter in our apartment in central Israel. When the booms started outside shortly before 2 a.m., shaking my shutters and waking me from a fitful sleep, I went to my balcony to scan the skies. I didn't get much shut-eye over the next few hours while Israel's anti-missile system shot down the threats along with the help of Israeli, U.S., U.K., and even Jordanian warplanes. We were lucky. Our city has no air raid sirens. My kids slept through the entire assault, and the worst casualty of the attack appeared to be a serious injury to a 7-year-old Arab Israeli girl. I actually felt more danger a few days earlier when I was in the northern Israeli city of Kiryat Shmona, interviewing someone outside his fast food restaurant, and an air raid siren sounded. There, the threat is more immediate. Hezbollah was just over the next hill, and we only had seconds to take cover. As our phones buzzed with alerts from Israel's Homefront Command, my interlocutor hopped up from our sidewalk table and rushed me into his kitchen, along with a half dozen customers there for a late lunch. Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed Lebanese militia, was firing missiles, probably from the mountain ridge just a mile and a half away, demarcating Israel's border with Lebanon. A minute later came another alert and another siren, drone infiltration. When the threat passed, we headed back outside. Just steps away from our table were the scorched remains of a Hezbollah strike from November, when a missile hit some gas canisters, exploded, and set the street and nearby vehicles ablaze. A bystander was hospitalized with shrapnel wounds to the chest, but no one was killed. This city of 25,000 was evacuated in the early days of Israel's war with Hamas after Hezbollah joined in and began shelling northern Israel. 6 months on, the only change is that Hezbollah's attacks, at least 3,100 so far, according to the Israel Defense Forces, have grown more frequent. About 24 civilians and soldiers in northern Israel have been killed, while Israeli reprisals in Lebanon and Syria have killed more than 350, most of whom have been Hezbollah fighters. The persistence of the conflict in northern Israel, including Iran's attack this weekend, is a reminder that although the war in Gaza has shifted to a low burn, the regional conflict is still very much unresolved. For those of us living in Israel, it's hard to shake the feeling that we're treading water, moving no closer to resolution of the urgent dilemmas. That's hard enough for ordinary Israelis. It's gut-wrenching for the families of those still held captive in Gaza, the 60,000 residents of northern Israel who've been evacuated due to attacks by Hezbollah, and the countless other Israelis displaced from their destroyed communities near Gaza. It also weighs on the spirits of those who have lost loved ones in this war and those still serving in the army. Israel faces four major unresolved issues that raise fundamental questions about the country's future. How will Israel restore security to its northern border region so that residents can return to their homes? Second, how does Israel plan to resolve the war in Gaza, adequately address the humanitarian crisis facing Gazans, and deliver real security to Israel's southern border communities? Third, will Israel be able to recover its surviving hostages in Gaza, and how many more will die before that happens? And fourth, how long must Israelis wait before they get a chance to weigh in on the country's leadership with a vote? And what will Israel's political realignment look like after elections? The answers to these questions will shape Israel's future. But instead of tackling them, Israel's parliament went on recess, not to return until mid-May. The government is abandoning us, said Tony Abutbul, owner of the shawarma restaurant I visited in Kiryat Shmona, where a few hundred people remain in the evacuated city. I support any decision to end this situation so we can go back to normal life. In many ways, the war in northern Israel represents the greatest conundrum. Compared with Hamas, Hezbollah is a much more potent threat. It has more and better trained fighters, more advanced weaponry, and a powerful patron in Iran. Despite Israeli counterstrikes, including on Iranian military commanders and Hezbollah supply lines, its offensive capabilities remain very much intact. In an all-out war, Hezbollah likely would wreak far more destruction inside Israel than Hamas rockets have. Yet without a war, Israelis who live near the border won't be able to return to their homes until Hezbollah decides to stop attacking them. Even then, how will they be able to sleep securely without the fear that one day Hezbollah will storm across the border and do exactly the same thing to them that Hamas did to residents of southern Israel? It's no secret that Hezbollah long has harbored plans for an October 7th-style attack. In Gaza, the war to bring security to Israel's southern communities is underway, but it's far from clear that it will achieve its aim of defeating Hamas. The group's offensive capabilities have been degraded but not destroyed, and 133 Israeli hostages remain in captivity. At least 30 of them are confirmed dead. Right now, it feels like a stalemate. Meanwhile, Israel's handling of the war, including the killing of more than 32,000 Palestinians, is ravaging its international standing. Allies are halting arms sales to Israel or facing intense public pressure to do so. The United Nations Security Council has called for a ceasefire in Gaza, and young people all over the world are calling for a free Palestine, from the river to the sea, a call that Israelis understand to mean the nation's elimination. Finally, there's the question of leadership. Israel's leaders are the people who failed to prevent the October 7th attack or react quickly enough once it started to stop Hamas murder, kidnapping, rape, and arson. There will have to be an accounting. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, clinging to power with the help of his far-right allies and unwilling even to offer an apology for his failures, has resisted calls for early elections. Israel is stuck with its leaders, its hostage crisis, tens of thousands of internal refugees, and an unresolved war. How much longer can this endure? Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And that concludes the opinion page. And now we'll move to the sports. And, of course, our favorite sports figure, Caitlin Clark. How does Clark fit on Indiana Fever's roster? Caitlin Clark would make any WNBA team better. But she is the perfect fit for what the Indiana Fever needs, Clark, who is expected to be drafted number one overall to the Fever in Monday's WNBA draft, will very likely join the starting lineup for the Fever, pairing her with reigning Rookie of the Year center Aaliyah Boston, third-year forward Nalissa Smith, veteran forward Katie Lou Samuelson, and 2023 All-Star guard Kelsey Mitchell. At this point, Indiana has the front court figured out. Boston and Smith are a dangerous duo in the paint, averaging 14.5 and 15.5 points per game, respectively. Especially with a year under Boston's belt, she has learned to fight through the lane to get high-percentage shots. Samuelson is a veteran who can stretch the floor in both a guard and forward role, and Clark, the Fever have found exactly what they need in the backcourt, a confident point guard who can run through traffic, direct plays, and still score herself at a high volume. Her biggest competition for the point guard starting role will be Erica Wheeler, who is in the final season of a two-year near-max contract with the Fever. Wheeler, an All-Star in 2019, started at point guard last season, averaging 9.9 points and 5.0 assists per game. But Wheeler isn't a strong three-point shooter. She shot just 2.4 three-pointers per game at a clip of 30.9%. Something the Fever desperately missed last season was multiple consistent three-point shooters. Kelsey Mitchell was the only player to attempt more than 100 three-pointers in the 40-game season, and she made 39.8% of her shots beyond the arc. The Fever's three-point game was easy to guard, though, as opponents only needed to focus on Mitchell, who was the only person to shoot over 31% from beyond the arc, other than Boston, who only took 12 threes last season. Adding Clark will help spread out the floor with a 37.7 career shooting percentage behind the arc and countless flashy long-range threes from her college career. WNBA veterans will make it a point to keep close to her defensively. It still stands to be determined if Coach Christy Sides will let her pull up from the logo in transition. Sides is a methodical coach, and most of her game plans do not include transition three-pointers. But there also has not been a player on Fever's roster that can consistently make those long threes. So only time will tell to see if Sides will open up a different side of the playbook. The Iowa guard's extravagant post-entry passes, too, will open up a new set of plays for the second-year Fever coach, as the Iowa guard averaged 8.2 assists per game throughout her college career. Clark played a more traditional back-to-the-basket post offense in her first 3 years at Iowa, and she easily dropped in no-look or behind-the-back passes to center Monica Cisnano. Sure, the WNBA is becoming more positionless each year, but Boston has the strength to not only catch those passes from Clark, but go up against the best centers in the league to get those passes through the hoop. Clark also got some more positionless assist work in her final year at Iowa as the Hawkeyes transitioned to more of a fluid offense with no true center. With Clark the bona fide missing piece for Indiana, the Fever will have its most complete starting lineup since Tramika Catchings retired in 2016. It should be enough for the Fever to improve upon their 13-27 record from last season and possibly make the playoffs, where Indiana has not been since 2016. Jeff?
Briefly, we'll tell you that Scottie Scheffler wins his second Masters in 3 years. Unflappable American Scottie Scheffler claimed a second Masters title in 3 years on Sunday, the world number one holding steady while his biggest challengers self-destructed, making their way through the infamous Amen Corner. Scheffler, the green jacket winner in 2022, began the day with a one-stroke lead over twice major winner Colin Morikawa and posted a final round of 4-under-68 to finish 11-under for the week, four clear of Swedish young gun Ludvig Åberg. Time for Dear Abby. Carol, back to you.
Thank you, Jeff. Dear Abby, my niece, Ellie, and her husband, Liam, have been self-employed for 20 years, but due to the economy, Liam decided to go into the workforce. He's now employed at a state job with great pay and benefits for them and their four children. Our family is elated for him and his family, except Ellie. She can't stand for Liam to be away from her. She fights daily with him, telling him he has chosen a job over his family. They were always a nice family unit, but now Ellie is destroying it because of the insecure, overbearing control she needs to have. It's heartbreaking to see. I wish I could make Ellie understand that this job means they will no longer be struggling financially. But she doesn't care. She wants to be near Liam at all times. The situation is awful. I can't believe they may end up in divorce court because her husband got a great state job. Your thoughts on this, please? Signed, Helpless, in Pennsylvania. And Abby says, Dear Helpless, I think your niece's insecurity and insistence on having her husband on a short lease at all times is unhealthy, to say the least. She needs professional help, and Liam should insist upon it. If she refuses, he will then have to decide whether the current status of their marriage is something he wants to tolerate for the foreseeable future and plan his next steps accordingly. Dear Abby, my husband and I retired 6 years ago and moved from California to Texas. I have two grown sons, and my husband has two grown daughters still living in California. My husband's oldest daughter, who is 50, just came to visit along with her 10-year-old daughter. On the Sunday they were to leave, my husband was to take them to the airport in the morning and leave me home to read my Sunday paper. Before they left, his daughter wanted a picture of all of us together. I told her I didn't want a picture taken in my nightgown, but she said it would only be from the neck up. I acquiesced, and she took the shot. 2 days later, former clients of mine from California posted on Facebook how glad they were to see me look so happy in retirement. My husband showed me the Facebook posting of me from the waist up in my nightgown on his daughter's page. I don't go on Facebook. I don't want my likeness on Facebook. And I'm not happy that after expressing my feelings about having my picture taken in my nightgown, his daughter put me on Facebook. Isn't it common decency to ask someone before arbitrarily posting their picture on Facebook? Signed, Not Happy, in Texas. And Abby replies, Dear Not Happy, I am going to assume that your husband's daughter did not post the family picture on her page to inflame you. She may have forgotten her promise to you. Because this is not the impression of your happy retirement you want to convey, ask her to take it down and hope she complies. If she doesn't, do not pose for any more family pictures when she is behind the camera. What do you think about that, Jeff?
The fewer pictures of me on the internet, the better for the internet, I think. Well, that brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today. I'm Jeff. My partner at the microphone is Carol. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.